Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Welcome to the PTSD and Beyond podcast, where we give you insights into post-traumatic stress, trauma recovery, healing, and beyond. I'm Dr. Deb Lind, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind, touch your heart, and connect with your spirit, and also give you a greater understanding of yourself and others on this healing and recovery journey walked by so many of us before, wounded healers with lived experience and heroes. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into possibilities and purpose, hope, and inspiration. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. One last thing, guys. Before we dive into today's episode, if you'd like an ad-free experience and like early access to new episodes and special events, I want to let you know you can join us at patreon.com. That is patreon.com/PTSD and beyond. All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. And you know what? I got to tell you one thing about social media is you just never know who you're going to meet. And I have to say another thing is that there are so many people that are just brilliant. They have all of these little nuggets of wisdom and just things that make me stop and go, you know what? We've got to have this person on. And it's really funny because then when you do connect with somebody, and I say funny in the sense of if you don't ask, you don't know. And they, you know, you connect with them and you say, hey, you know what? I love what you share. And I want to be able to provide a different platform for you. Are you interested in coming on and talking to our audience? And it's super cool when someone says yes. And today's guest, I want to just quickly mention here that they're a person that I followed. And it, you know, it's one of these pinch me moments that he's actually on today. This person's got a doctorate of philosophy from the California School of Professional Psychology. He is a psychologist as well as an educator, works as an adjunct faculty member, teaches graduate school as well as undergraduate school in the university setting since 2001. So you know what that means? That means this person is like uber super smart. If you go on his bio and you look at his website, we're going to have all his information in the bio summary. You're going to be like, oh my gosh, you know what? What are we going to talk about today? Which is a totally cool thing for you to stick around and make sure that you pay attention and take notes. Because I'm telling you, when you listen to Dr. Harry Stark, you're going to say, oh, you know what? That was the episode that made it for me. And other things that he's doing right now, he's authored a study on development of assessment tools for social activity in older adults, as well as co-authored a study on repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation. Guys, let's give a heartfelt PTSD and Beyond welcome to Dr. Harry Stark. Dr. Stark, welcome to PTSD and Beyond.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on. Like I mentioned, you know, I follow you every day on Twitter and I see the things that you post. And again, there's just so many pieces of information and nuggets. There's one thing about Twitter is that we have a condensed space to share something that whether it's on our mind or a quote, but something to resonate about a thought, a feeling, an emotion, and to captivate somebody. And I truly believe that you do that effectively. And I know you've done it for me, which is why I reached out and said, hey, you know what? I really want to have you on. Talk with us a little bit about who you are. And when you do post stuff, you know, what meaning does it have? What meaning does it have and what purpose does it have?
Well, I'm a psychologist and I came to this career after a lot of consideration. I actually graduated undergrad degree in film and was not tremendously happy working in that industry. And it was one of those things where I turned to my wife and she said, whatever it takes to put a smile on your face, but clearly working in film is not doing it. And I really did the things that I would learn later on that I would counsel my own clients to do. And that is really took some time and didn't, I'm a cautious person by nature. And so started to investigate, interviewed some people, took a few classes, found that I was like a fish in water. And next thing you know, it's like, yeah, give me the PhD because I want the whole kit and caboodle.
I love that. Give me the PhD because I want the whole kit and caboodle. And it's not something that a lot of people do. But when you do have that type of education, Do you find that, I mean, you run into people and you're like, oh yeah, you've got an advanced, you know, education in grad school also. Before getting my doctorate, I hadn't met very many people with that level of education. What kind of things when you were working on your doctorate, can you say have trickled over to, you know, applied in your practice right now?
So much, if I had to like create a top priority list, I would say, you know, just the idea of really knowing that it stinks to spend your time doing something that's not meaningful to you. And if something is meaningful to you, then you can tolerate whatever hurdles you got to go over and get to, because that's what you want to do. And for people that come into blockades, it really bothers me. Mm-hmm. And I'm loath to put, well, frame it as, well, I did this, so you should be able to, but rather I just feel like my experience tells me that it's important. Mm-hmm. If somebody's got real barriers to getting to what they want, then at least acknowledge there is something that they want. But mm-hmm. so that's sort of what I bring to the table and from my own experience, just knowing that it's so important. If you got the time, you've got something you can identify, go after it.
You mentioned about meaningful work. How do you think that COVID has shaped other people with taking a pause and reflecting on, you know, what does meaningful work look like, as well as what does a meaningful life look like?
Well, you know, that's a really big question, and we'd need about 6 or 7 of these meetings.
A whole workshop, right?
Yeah. I think I'm going to sound really old on this to a lot of people, but I think when you peel away the distractions, the things that have populated our day-to-day lives, mm-hmm. that really are more space fillers than soul fillers or gut fillers or whatever, then you're left with this vacuum of wondering, well, what is going on? Mm-hmm. You know, when you can no longer just shoot off and go to a movie theater and fill in a couple of hours with a movie. Now we've got streaming stuff and whatever, which people turn to fiercely, which I think speaks to how much people were frightened by having space. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you don't have the day-to-day jobs, and unfortunately that was a real negative, painful thing that a lot of people experienced and continue to experience, but when you don't have a lot of those day-to-day exchanges, the things that have kind of filled your day, scheduled your day, structured your day, and you're left with, okay, well, what am I going to do? Okay, yeah. I'm not meeting somebody. And there's only so many times you can turn to Netflix or Amazon or whatever. Zoom. And at a certain point, you kind of go, well, sort of, what is this all about? As Monty Python asked in Meaning of Life, what is it all about? Why am I here? What am I doing here?
That's a really good question. What am I doing here? Why am I here? And there's, you know, through our artists, we can look at, you know, lyrics and song about space. Why is it that space makes people feel uncomfortable? And we've been in a space and for over a year now. And people keep talking about like the challenges of COVID, you know, what do you see as far as maybe some hope opportunities or some growth opportunities because of the space that we've had? And it's been a space that we've been forced to be in. It wasn't something by choice. I mean, a pandemic forces you to do things that you wouldn't normally do. So what do you think are some of the, you know, the, even if it's hypothetical, you know, a hypothesis that I have is these are some things that I believe we're going to start seeing, and maybe we won't be able to collect that data for another 5, 15, 20 years.
I think, again, I could just pick something out that just occurs to me now, but I'm sure I could come up with 12 other things. But right now, going off of what you're saying, is opportunity. One of the things that's inherent in my personality, and that could just be because of my own life experiences, I hate missed opportunities. I hate waste. And I think on a societal level, we have such a tremendous opportunity to kind of connect, want to connect, or recognize that we could want to connect, mm-hmm. and really share what our individual experiences have been. You know, even the person who feels like their life hasn't been impacted significantly, why is that? And can, you know, what does that mean to them, having seen other people whose lives have been turned over 15 ways, you know, to see that? And then the person who had their life turned over so many ways, and, you know, how can they share that, or will they share that with others? And so I think that there's a tremendous empathy opportunity here, which I hope people take. I hope people really grasp at that.
What would you say to the person who, thank you for sharing those thoughts, by the way, thank you for that, the opportunity, especially to develop and connect. One of the phrases, for some reason, I don't know why this is coming to me, but there's a, and I'm summarizing it. I know that you're going to know it. I don't know it by heart, but it's something about waste, like waste, not want, or something like that.
Waste, not want. Not.
Yes. Waste, not want. Right. So we have an opportunity. We're not going to waste it. We're going to embrace it. And that looks different for every person. And then in addition to connecting with your community, there's a value of what happens for the individual. So to the person maybe who's out there that's saying, I want that. I wish I had that. What are some maybe first steps that they could actually take to do that?
Calm down. You know, it's, I keep seeing, you know, the poster behind you, PTSD and beyond, you know, the current research in PTSD starts off with calm down. And I don't mean it. And the way I've been taught it and learning it, I don't experience it as a denigrating, you know, kind of authoritarian parental thing or whatever. It's just, that's the science. Calm down, calm your body, because to take advantage of this opportunity mm-hmm. means that you're going to encounter discomfort. And we've got hardwired into our brains to shy away from discomfort. It's a very normal response to say, I don't like how this makes me feel, and therefore I'm not going to do it. That's very normative. It takes tremendous willpower to go against that current, against that grain. And so what I would advise people to, if they're intrigued to take advantage of this, first and foremost, calm down, calm your body to the best that you can. Learn to really recognize the physical elements of stress, because those usually come on before we recognize the emotional elements of stress. And learn to understand that that's because you're uncomfortable. Approaching another person without trusting that that person's going to listen to you, recognize you, acknowledge you, reciprocate with you, that's scary. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a lot of courage to engage in that process. But courage doesn't mean just brute force your way through it.
Right.
Courage means like, okay, I'm going to face this. You brought up when we were chatting before about Alfred Adler. You know, Alfred Adler talked so much about courage is not knowing you're going to overcome or succeed. Courage is just, I'm going to face the challenge. And whatever happens, I'll figure out how to pull myself together afterwards. But it's not about, I know I'm going to win.
Right. That is so true. There's so many elements here. You know, courage is making the decision and taking action that I'm going to face this regardless of what the outcome is. And that, you know, the way is through. And there's something to be said about we as meaning people can learn from animals. So if you think about how salmon swim upstream, I mean, they deliberately go against the current. And it's true, you know, oftentimes we'll shy away from things, or we have these stories that play in our head. And, you know, like the snowball effect, right? It starts off as a thought. And the next thing, you know, you've got this large mass of this, you know, story that plays inside our mind. And yet we're still sitting on the, you know, on the chair at the kitchen table. And we haven't even done anything yet because we create this story. And to calm our body down, that's an excellent point to make with our audience, is that the body feels it first before the awareness is there that something's going on. And to talk with people about space fillers, you know, something that folks can identify with is to ask themselves the question, what am I filling my space with? And back to your original point, when you mentioned about, you know, studying film, you know, is that space filler something that stinks and not meaningful, and I don't want to spend my time on it anymore?
Right, right. You know, so again, seeing as I already brought up Alfred Adler, one of the things that attracted me to his theory of individual psychology is that it's a theory of use, and that just resonated so much for me. My upbringing, my social environment, my culture very much emphasized being of use. So when I got to grad school and I started looking at all these theorists and whatever, I'm like, wow, this one, he's the one for me. And it was only after I made that decision, I go, oh, well, okay, so this is where he is, and looking at his background. And so going to this idea of space fillers, I think I acknowledge everybody needs a break. You know, we have to give the brain a chance to recover.
Right.
But space fillers means you're not being of use. You're not creatively productive in some way. And I wouldn't want anybody hearing me say that think that I'm cracking the whip and saying get to work. Yeah. But it's like you're here. Your life is here. It's limited. Nobody goes on forever. And so let's make use of it. And to me, the usefulness is the connective stuff, you know, making a difference in a person's life, seeing that you matter and letting other people know they matter, things like that. So yeah, as a counter to space filler, that's wasting time. Maybe that's my father talking now, but it still feels right.
And there's different layers and levels of space filler. So for example, maybe somebody is using a space filler to literally, you know, recharge their body. So they're going mm-hmm. through a meditation, they're doing yoga, or maybe they're cooking. You know, I think that there's something to be said. And I know Jon Kabat-Zinn talks about autopilot. So when a space filler is an autopilot, then it really is a waster as opposed to an enhancer, if you will, or something that's nourishing and that, you know, fills our bucket as opposed to just is a bucket.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think on a just like a practical example of that, in my own practice as a clinician, I have the breaks between clients mm-hmm. where I'm not going to carry over what was going on with the client at 1 o'clock with my client at 2 o'clock. I have to have that break so I can kind of like an etch-a-sketch, you know, shake the thing and clear the brain out a bit so I can be completely with the next client. And at the end of the day, you know, my wife sometimes complains, why, you know, you don't work so very far from home. Why does it take you so long after your last client? I said, because my response is you don't want the me that's at the end of the day walking through the door here. I need that time to kind of recalibrate and remind myself who I am and, you know, where I am and where I'm going. And so, yeah, you know, when you do it purposefully, then it's not autopilot. Then it's very meaningful. Mm-hmm. You can do this, the most ridiculous, non-productive thing, but it can be very productive if it's recovering, you know, and it's allowing your body and your mind to recuperate and get prepared for the next thing.
That recuperation is so important that we have folks that are in law enforcement and other frontline folks that will say the same phrase, you know what? I don't work far from home, but I take a longer route because I need to calm down, or I need to come down from my day's work. And then, you know, usually the partner or spouse will say, why did it take you so long to get home? You know, yeah, it's like, I understand what you're saying. And there's people out there I know in our PTSD and beyond community that are raising their hand right now going, yeah, see, see, it's not, I'm not the only one alone. I have another question asking.
Before you go to your another question, but don't forget your question. There's something in what you just said that I got to comment on. One of the things that I get asked by my students constantly is, how do I leave work at work? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I tell them consistently is, I have not come across a single graduate program in psychology that teaches it. I don't believe in luck. And I'm very grateful that the probability had it that I encountered some really good mentors for me. And they helped me learn how to do that. And in hearing what you were saying about frontline workers, you know, law enforcement, et cetera, and I've worked with people in law enforcement, and it's still true. Not any of those programs teaches the people how to leave work at work. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's there and I'm limited in my exposure, but I don't think it's out there.
I don't think it's out there either. And it's certainly a need for folks. It certainly is an unmet need, especially when people have seen just such horrific things. And I've been on that other end where it's, hey, I need to talk with somebody. And, you know, I'm hearing about their day. And to help them actually do that, to be able to transition from work life to home life, whether it's law enforcement, somebody in construction services where it's high risk, maybe there was something that they saw. But there has got to be a way that we can do better and help those folks, especially because the mind can only take so much.
Oh, absolutely. We all have our breaking point. And our society has advanced way beyond what our brains have evolved to manage. And it's a tough situation. We're living in a world that a lot of us are not equipped neurologically to be in.
Mm-hmm. My next question I want to ask you is, when you reflect back on your career and you think about people who have influenced you and then made an impression. And why I'm asking this question is because I recently connected with my seventh grade choir teacher. And why I'm laughing is because I was a kid that didn't talk till I was 3 years old. And so now here I am hosting, global podcast. And I remember Mr. Stidham saying something to that 13-year-old girl. And I reconnected with him and asked him if he would be a guest. And so we have people who influence us where we're maybe at the time we don't really think about how much they've influenced us. But who are some folks that have influenced you in your career and your personal life? And what are ways that they've touched you that way?
Okay. So hearing first off, bravo, you kind of caught me off guard there. And at first I was thinking, oh my God, I got to come up with somebody. But then it's like, what do you mean, oh my God, I got to come up with somebody? I know this. I use these examples all the time with my kids, with my clients, with my students. So I will tell you, I won't say he's the most significant, but in the realm of teachers, I would say, I got to think, fifth or sixth grade, I was at school, there was a test, and I failed the test. I was ill-prepared. Between you and me, I was a horrible student as a kid. Awful.
And yet you have a PhD now, right? I mean, so the person who's out there listening that's saying, oh, I'm just a C student, right? And you're an undergrad, guess what? It's okay.
That's right. When you find what you want and it clicks, all the motivation in the world starts happening. So anyway, so I had this test in the daytime and I failed it. I knew I failed it. And indicative of me, it didn't move me one way or the other. And that's a whole story in and of itself. So end of the day, school's over, and I'm taking the bus home. Now, my bus ride home had me taking two buses. And I pick up, I go to the bus stop that's right near the school, and I get on the bus, you know, whatever. And the bus isn't pulling away, which is not unusual, whatever. And then I see the teacher from the class that I had taken the test and failed. Wow. He gets on the bus. And as every, you know, sixth grader, you know, I'm thinking that that's how old I was. Everyone does is like, oh my God. And, you know, it's like in my mind, don't sit next to me. Don't sit next to me. Don't sit next to me. And of course he sits right opposite me. And we're not talking the bench seats that are side, you know, like, you know, lateral 90 degrees to the bus. We're talking like we're facing each other.
Oh, wow.
And he pulls out his briefcase and he pulls out the exams. He's looking at me. I mean, he's cheerful, whatever. He says, hi, and whatever. I'm like, hi. And and he starts grading the tests. And I see him flipping through the papers and he pulls out my test. And he starts grading it. And I'm like, oh, whatever a sixth grader at that time would know to say in terms of the epithets for how I'm responding. And he starts asking me questions, just, you know, conversational questions like, you know, if you were faced with this kind of a situation, how would you respond? And you know, what do you think about this topic? What do you think why this person was doing this and that person was doing that? And I'm responding to his questions. And I didn't know it at the time. Of course, looking back on it now, I understand what he was doing. He was giving me the whole test.
Wow.
And he looked at me at the end and he said, I don't know why you didn't give these answers on the test. And he said, and I don't even remember what grade he gave me. I was about to like plug in and he gave me an A. I honestly don't remember. I do remember, though, that he changed my grade.
Wow.
And I believe he made it a passing grade. How much of a passing grade? I don't remember. That experience taught me so much about the process of education and the process of just relating with another human being. Mm-hmm. What somebody gives you in one paradigm or one structure is not really indicative of who they are. Mm-hmm. It may be all you have to go on, but if you have an opportunity to connect with somebody, to learn more about them beyond the prima facie stuff, that idea of like, wow, somebody took the time to want to know more about me, that's been a guide to me. And I do a little bit of that with my students now, my undergrads, grads, whatever. You know, if they do office hours and they want to go over a quiz or a test, and I'm going over it. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm asking them, so do you understand why the answer was incorrect? And they'll say, yeah. And I'll say, can you give me an example? And then I'm ready to change their grade at the end of that process. I'll say, okay, so, you know, you don't get a 70%. You actually get more like an 85. I'm in this to teach. I'm not in this to grade. So I believe you learned something. And so that's really a testimony to that teacher from sixth grade. And it's things like that. Other people that are, I mean, I mentioned my father earlier. One piece of wisdom that he gave me was that I should always learn so much so I could realize just how little I know, which was, you know, his way of using a little bit of irony, but also, am I using the term irony correctly? Well, anyways, confusion. In order to not so much put me in my place, but just to encourage me that I should never feel like I'm never getting it because mm-hmm. I can never get it. Mm-hmm. And so let's just be in the process. So examples like that, those are the things that have really inspired me. And as I mentioned, my mentors in grad school, helping me understand theory, helping me understand how to operate on purpose and how to be genuine and just respecting other people and the value of experiencing another human being and that another human being experienced. Those types of things have really just stuck with me. And then music also, tremendous influence on me.
That's so cool. I love the story. And thank you for sharing about your teacher and being on the bus, including your dad and other mentors. And I love this self quote here. You say, and you said, I'm in this to teach, not to grade.
Yeah.
That's beautiful right there. I mean, that talks about soul touching, you know, versus kind of like versus that red pen, right? Don't have to have a red pen to go through life. You can scrap the red pen and have a highlighter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, and I will tell you that first and foremost, I appreciate what you're saying. I really do. And much like what I mentioned, I'm partially colorblind when we were talking before. That compliment, that appreciation, I recognize it rationally. It is a difficult thing for me to take in and really assimilate. But I know that that's a me thing. That's something I got to work on. But I really do appreciate you saying
that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you know, there's always somebody who's listening to the podcast who, you know, is taking notes and they're diligently thinking, how can I apply these things to my life? I'm trying to figure out what my life's purpose is. I also asked somebody the other day too about, do you feel that the career found you, or do you think that you found the career? What do you think about that? Did your career find you, or did you find the career?
I think I found the square hole from my square peg. I think this is who I've been, and it just took knowing that this is something you can do. You know, I'm sure you'll have an understanding of this. In my early years, I thought a psychologist was Bob Newhart walking to his office. He's got Emily was the wife. He's got the receptionist. He's got the dentist Carol. Down the hall, Carol, right? Carol. And then he's got his clients who come in, and he keeps, you know, sitting next to them or sitting opposite them, and Mr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so, whatever. And he does his sessions, and then he goes home. And that's what I always thought a psychologist was. And in reality, no, it's not. I could have actually gotten to this career much earlier if not for the fact that I just had, you know, so many blockades that I put on what I thought it was. And I actually had a undergrad professor, the one psychology class I took as an undergrad, who said something that really turned me off. She said, you can major in psychology, but just be prepared to be in school for the rest of your life. And it's like, whoa, that's scary. No, thank you.
It's interesting the things that educators say. I remember when I was finishing my master's, I had two babies. I'm talking little. Yeah, I had one of my kids halfway through master's program, and I wanted to go on and get my doctorate. So, of course, what do? You ask people that you trust. You ask people who are already doing what you want to do. And I had one professor actually say, if you don't do it, you're never going to do it. So you better go through and do it. But everybody else said, you shouldn't do it. You're crazy. You've got two babies. What are you thinking? Right. And it was because I listened to everybody else, and it just perplexed me. Like, not one of the people who I really looked up to said, yeah, you know. And it was this one professor who was my finance professor of all things. And I just asked her, like, well, what do you think about this? Everybody's telling me this is a crazy idea. I don't think this is crazy. I think this is quite logical. That's actually why I went to her, because I thought, I need somebody who's logical. And that's what she said. She's like, yeah, no, I'd go straight through if I were you. And these are the reasons why. And if you don't do it now, you're not going to do it. And by the time you finish, your, you know, youngest is going to be starting kindergarten. And I thought, yep, there you go. So it is interesting how we can influence people. Even now, you know, the stories that you're sharing have influenced you and shaped, you know, mindsets and things that you have gone through and that you've, you know, accomplished, as well as people that are listening right now thinking, hey, you know what, I want some more of this. So my next
question. So before you go to your next question, you just tripped another thing in my mind, another person who deserves absolute credit for my doctorate is a friend of mine at this office where I was working and still trying to figure things out. And I And I was starting to contemplate going for the PhD and, you know, getting into psychology. And I was so worried about how much time it would take. And I was having a conversation with her. She was an older adult, but we got along really, really well. And I said to her, God, I'm going to be so old when I get the doctorate. And she looked at me and she said, well, do you plan on being that old anyway? I'm like, yeah. She goes, so why not have the doctorate when you get there?
There you go. I love that. That's a great mindset right there. I mean, you're going to hit that age anyway, right? So you might as well. So the person out there that's listening, like, should I not? You know, think about that. You're going to hit that age anyway. So, you know, why not? Right?
Absolutely.
I wanted to touch a little bit about meaning and purpose, because we originally in our conversation, we had some points about meaning and purpose. And Dr. Viktor Frankl, you know, Holocaust survivor, you know, talked for decades about, you know, finding meaning, man's, you know, mission to find meaning in life. And what do you think meaning, what do you think meaning of life is all about?
I think it's the difference between watching a baseball game and playing a baseball game. I think it's the difference between watching a musician play something and playing the thing. There's nothing wrong with being an observer, but it's a different experience. And I think in our lives, we have so many opportunities, if we would just give ourselves a chance to ask ourselves the curiosity questions. What is this to me? Mm-hmm. Why am I looking at this the way I'm looking at it? Without the pressure of coming up with the right answer. Just allowing that it's more about the process. It's more about the exploration to investigate and know more and learn more. I can point to so many different careers and things and jobs that people do where they're just kind of automatons going through it, or they're actually kind of recognizing something in it. Even something that would appear to be so completely boring can have meaning in it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, makes all the difference in the world is, you know, asking yourself the question, what is this about? Why am I doing this? How is this affecting me? How do I want it to affect me? Why am I not getting what I want? What is it about me that's, you know, stopping this or slowing it down? Or why do I keep finding myself in the same place all over again? Mm-hmm. You know, just asking those questions without the pressure of saying, ah, here's the answer. Now I know how to fix things.
Right.
That's very outcome oriented. Mm-hmm. Get into the process. And you're already advancing. You're already making progress because you're deepening whatever it is that you're contemplating, whatever it is you're experiencing. And I think you can do that truly with anything. With anything.
I love that. Here's another self quote. You can. I'm taking notes here too, so I'll share this with you. You're brilliant. We have so many opportunities if we just give ourselves a chance. It's just so brilliant. Really, truly.
Thank you.
For the last few nuggets to share with our listeners, what are some things that you'd like to share with them? Maybe a few more nuggets here.
All right. So, gosh, if I have an audience to talk about Alfred Adler, I will always do that. It's important to recognize that we want to accomplish things. We want to feel good about ourselves. And all the time, we're responding to what we believe is missing in ourselves. And I think it's really important to question that part of it. I mean, Adler would talk about, okay, go and feel good about yourself, but do it in a healthy way. Mm. But he would also question, you know, just how rooted in reality is this thing that's not so good about yourself? You know, I mentioned that I'm partially colorblind. I don't see that as a deficit in my character or my humanity. In some ways, it's actually an advantage. So it's like, how often people just see the deficits, the minuses, the brokenness within themselves, and respond accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And when maybe a better question could be, is this really a deficit? Is this really a minus? Is this really a brokenness in me? So I would always ask people to challenge their beliefs about themselves, so that they can really have, you know, exercise a little bit of compassion. You know, how I was saying to you, you gave me a really a tremendous compliment, and that was hard for me to take in. And that's a similar thing. How often does the casual person experience a compliment and an appreciation from another human being, and it just goes right over their head, or in one ear and out the other, or it bounces off of them, you know,
or dismiss it by saying something like, "Oh, you look nice today. Oh, this is so old. I've had this forever." You know, one of those things. I know everybody out there that's listening, we've all done that. We've all done it.
Yeah, so the filmmaker Richard Curtis, his most recent film that had any notoriety was this movie Yesterday. It was all Beatles kind of related. But he did another movie. I don't remember if he directed, but I'm pretty sure he wrote it, called About Time. And it's a romantic comedy, and it deals with like time travel. Anytime you got a movie with dealing with time travel, I'm all in. And it's just very interesting and so poignant to me that he ends the movie with a person who has the ability to time travel, re-experiencing each day. Like he does the day and then he re-experiences the same day. And as the film is showing it, now he's noticing the smiles. Now he's noticing the people who are helping other people. Now he's noticing where he can help somebody and whatever. And that was just such a, like, that's humanity. That's the humanity that I wanna spread out there. You know, just notice these things. We don't need to time travel in order to do it. It's just, you got to train yourself to find it and see it. And if you don't see it, then put it out there. I tell my students, I've gotten in the habit of telling my students that, you know, good doesn't just happen. You got to make it happen. And so that's something that I really was stimulated by what you were just saying. So as nuggets go, that's another nugget.
That's beautiful. Good doesn't just happen. You got to make it happen.
Yeah.
Dr. Stark, thank you so much for being on today and having a wonderful conversation. Really, it was a true pleasure to continue to just, you know, be in your presence and to just absorb all of this. I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I, you know, Deb, Dr. Deb, it's been very much a pleasure for me. This has been a meaningful experience, and I really do appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Truly. Thank you so much. Guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond, and I'll have Dr. Stark's information in his summary bio. So ways to connect with him on Twitter, his website, and all the other information as far as contact information. You can go ahead and connect with them. And remember, when you do, mention that, hey, I heard you live on PTSD and Beyond, and I got a question about whether it's Adler, about grad school, about little nuggets and things. And I do think you should write a book, by the way. You got to have somebody like a research grad assistant, you know, just collect all of these little snippets, especially on your Twitter feed, and then you'll have yourself a wonderful coffee table book. But guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. Remember to subscribe, because when you subscribe, then you get an automatic notification when a new episode drops. And people who do that get to see the episode the day before. And if you do like this episode, remember to like and comment. The higher that we get our ratings, the more people then we get to help. And then we have a greater community. So, all right, you guys, you have it a good one. We'll see you next time.